Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Los Angeles and the search for a cultural center. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. L.A. has famously been many suburbs in search of a city. Now the suburbs are building their own cultural centers to compete with the ones downtown. Why take the 10 to the Music Center when you can see the Globe Theater do Shakespeare at Santa Monica's Broad Stage? Why drive the 101 to Disney Hall when there's a world-class orchestra at the new Valley Performing Arts Center in Northridge? What's happened to the Grand Avenue project anyway? Also tonight, airtime for state employees means retirement pay for years when they don't actually work. Later on, Egypt's ripple effect on the Middle East. First, here's the news. Warren Ali back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Since Mubarak of Egypt was ousted by people power, protesters have hit the streets all over the Arab world. Is there a chance for democracy? Is Turkey the best model for a modern Islamic state? We'll hear more on that later. First, California's public employees' retirement system is chronically underfunded. Asked how to fix it, Governor Brown told reporters a good place to start would be getting rid of the ability to buy airtime. You don't know about airtime? Anthony York can explain. He reports from Sacramento for the LA Times. Anthony, always good to have you.
Good to be back with you.
What is airtime?
Airtime is a credit that state employees are eligible to purchase. They can purchase up to 5 years of credit for their pensions for years that they haven't worked. Now, pensions are calculated as a percentage of an employee's highest salary, multiplied by the number of years that they've served. And so this is essentially a boost of somewhere between 10 and 15% of an employee's pension payout that they have the ability to purchase directly from CalPERS.
Why should they be able to get retirement time or retirement money for years they haven't worked?
It's an interesting question and a fair question, and not one that we were able to get answered today for our story. We've asked the authors of the bill. We tried to ask Governor Davis, who signed the bill, and we asked the PERS board, and we were unable to get a satisfactory answer. I mean, all of the analyses of the plan say that it was meant to be cost neutral was a phrase that kept appearing in all the analyses. Essentially, the idea was that that employees would buy this benefit, they'd pay the money to PERS, and that PERS would invest the money in such a way that it would cover the cost for the entire benefit. But it didn't work out that way. All of the actuarial assumptions, all of the guesses that PERS made about how this would pay for itself turned out to be fundamentally wrong and cost the state tens of millions of dollars.
So PERS, of course, is the Public Employees Retirement System, and this goes all the way back to the administration of Governor Davis, who, as I understand it, vetoed it once and then signed it.
Well, he vetoed it once when it was crafted just to only apply to legislative staff, to legislative employees. He vetoed it saying that was unfair, that legislative staff would be entitled to a benefit not available to other state employees. And so the next year, the authors of the bill came back and had made it bigger, and now it applies to all state employees. So it's not just legislative staff that has the ability to buy this airtime, but it's any public employee. I believe it's available to teachers, also to county and city workers, as well as state employees.
And the legislative staffers wanted it because they lose pension credit when they run their bosses' election campaigns. They can't do that on public time.
Right. There's sort of a revolving door here in Sacramento of staff that they're like seasonal workers. They're here on the public payroll in between elections, and then when election season rolls around, they come off the state payroll, and they're farmed out to the competitive districts in places like San Diego Hanford and Long Beach and wherever the competitive races may be around the state in that particular cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're doing that, they're not public employees. They are private employees of the campaign, and they don't get vested pension benefits for that time. So they wanted to be able to buy some of that time back, as it were.
Okay, so still nobody has explained, neither the governor nor anybody else you've tried to talk to or that we've tried to talk to, why they should get credit for time that they didn't work. But it's a 7-8% guaranteed return. You quote Scott Hansen, who's an investment advisor, who says it's a phenomenal deal for retirees. He recommends them to take it, but it's an absolute fleecing of the taxpayers, to quote him.
Well, right. This is the airtime benefit is about half as much. To buy airtime is costs about half as much as it would cost to buy a similar annuity in the private sector. And so this is a benefit that's about twice as generous as what you and I could get out on the open market.
Okay, the mysteries of public financing, and particularly public retirement financing, are beginning to be made clear. Governor Brown knows about it. How's he going to get rid of it?
That is the $25 billion question, as it were. You know, there's a lot of discussion about pension reform in Sacramento. Airtime is just a small piece of that, and as Governor Brown himself said, it's just a potential place to start having a discussion. I mean, it's not going to the bigger discussions are much more fundamental in terms of what the state should be paying for pensions, whether there should be a cap on what the state pays out in pensions. And so those discussions may be folded into this budget discussion. It's something that's been a priority for Republican lawmakers for years and could very well be folded into this discussion of tax increases that the governor wants to have with legislators and eventually with voters.
Okay. In the meantime, airtime may become a symbol for a lot of the things that people object to about the way our government is structured. Anthony York, as always, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Reporter from Sacramento for the LA Times. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
We're on Only back with Which Way LA. The vision for Grand Avenue on Bunker Hill is to make it the cultural heart of Los Angeles. But the Grand Avenue Authority just gave the related companies yet another extension of the deadline to break ground on the residential commercial component. In the meantime, the suburbs, where many lovers of culture reside, are building their own centers. Most recently, Cal State University Northridge opened the Valley Performing Arts Center to rave reviews. Jolene Kester is the president of CSUN. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Tell us a bit, if you will, about the center and the extent to which you think it will compete with residents of the Valley with downtown L.A.
Well, the center is a 1,700-seat hall that is acoustically tunable. It's in a beautiful frame structure building, and the inside is also very beautiful with wonderful wood. But the most beautiful thing that's going to happen in this Valley Performing Arts Center is that the large number of people who live in this region, 1.6 to 2 million, depending on how you count, are going to have much easier access to a wide range of cultural programming.
How are you going to get cultural programming that competes with what they have downtown?
Well, we have a season that we're selling tickets for this spring, and it's we're getting incredibly positive responses from people in the region in terms of their interest in these performances. So what we're going to really be doing is adding to the cultural choices that people in the city of Los Angeles have, rather than setting the Valley Performing Arts Center up as a competitor of what takes place in Santa Monica or downtown L.A.
Part of what this means to the Valley is that there's finally a there since the earthquake of 1994.
Absolutely. When we first started contemplating building this Performing Arts Center here at Northridge, we were told of the other efforts that had happened in the past by local civic leaders to try to build some kind of a large entertainment center in the Valley. And there was great despair over the fact that none of those efforts had ever come to fruition. So what we have here now is a beautiful building, a large complex that's going to be used both for instruction and for people from all over Los Angeles to come and enjoy the arts. And we really do hope that this Valley Performing Arts Center will become a public space, a commons, if you will, for the cultural and creative life in this part of Los Angeles.
At the grand opening, a lot of people came from Hollywood and other parts of Los Angeles.
Yes, we had people from all over Southern California at the inaugural gala, and it was a grand affair because we were able to, in about a two-hour show, demonstrate all of the ways in which this performance hall can be used. We had film, because we can use this for movie premieres. We had comic a portion. We had beautiful dancing. We have a really, really great floor in the hall itself and in a rehearsal space. We had jazz. We had jazz players. We had instrumental players. We had jazz singers. We had theatrical performances. We had speaking. We had student performances. We had professional musicians. We had opera. We had classical music. So the entire array of artistic performance was presented and displayed this hall's very versatile capabilities.
Jolene Kester, again, president of California State University Northridge, or CSUN, doesn't want to set up a competition between that center and downtown, but the freeways are pretty crowded these days, and the West Side is another source of potential audiences for the Grand Avenue Project downtown. Since 2008, though, West Siders have been attending performances at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. Dale Franzen is the director there. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you offer at the Broad Stage, not as large as the Valley Performing Arts Center, but a beautiful, beautiful building.
Oh, thank you. I think that, speaking along the same lines as Jolene, I think more is better. In other words, why shouldn't Los Angeles, like every other important cultural center, have many different areas in which the cultural and performing arts are available? So the thinking behind the Broad Center is, when I looked at what was going on in Los Angeles, and speaking as a former classical musician, opera singer myself, what was missing to me was a small visual performing arts center similar to BAM in New York or the 92nd Street Y, and some of the more regional centers like that, where you can have a very intimate experience but right in your neighborhood so that you begin to take true ownership of the performing arts center, which I'm sure is what's going to happen with CSUN. But it's like anything else. When you buy a great picture, that doesn't make you not want to buy another great picture. Usually, great art breeds more great art. So the idea, I think, is that we don't replace downtown, and we never can replace downtown, but we add to it. And we, for instance, we have audience that is coming to our theater that none of us have ever seen at any theaters in L.A., which means it's a new audience. And that's what we all need to do. We all need to find new audiences. We went with a multi-purpose programming that ranges from dance to jazz to classical voice to recital to opera to theater, because that's what this neighborhood wanted, and that's what they're responding to. I mean, we have been overwhelmed with the response, and it's been so gratifying to see that even during these very difficult and challenging economic times, you know, truly, if you build it and you build it right and then you program it right, they will come. And they will ask for more. We've doubled our season in the last 3 years, and we're selling mostly to sold-out houses. And this is not even the end of our third year. So it's been quite an amazing ride.
Dale Franzen again, the director of the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. Ryan Valancourt is a reporter for the downtown, the Los Angeles Downtown News. He's been covering the latest developments with the Grand Avenue Project. And Ryan, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be here.
Do the people at the Grand Avenue Project feel that with these new facilities going up, maybe they aren't directly competitive, as I think neither of our other guests want to say, but are they falling behind the curve to some extent, and are they likely to be losing audience, particularly to those people who don't want to drive all that distance on the freeways?
You know, I don't think there's that sense right now. With the Grand Avenue Project, the delays involved have more to do with the residential and commercial components that you were talking about. I mean, for, you know, in large part, the cultural attractions are there and have been there. You already have Disney Concert Hall, you have the L.A. Phil, you have the L.A. Opera, you have Center Theater Group, all on Grand Avenue. What's been missing, if anything, as far as bringing a more 24-hour active pedestrian street life, is that residential component, the commercial, the restaurants, the things that, you know, you do have in over by the Broad stage, where people are more likely, for example, to come and have dinner beforehand and stay and have a drink afterwards. So that's what the stakeholders in this project are really focusing on. I think at the end of the day, everyone else on this call, like they've been saying, you know, more is better when it comes to cultural opportunities. But you can't really compare apples to apples anything with the L.A. Phil or the L.A. Opera or Center Theater Group. So the demand's always going to be there for that.
On the other hand, as you point out, Grand Avenue is pretty much empty in terms of other kinds of attractions. So it's that public commons aspect that I take it we don't have as yet in the Grand Avenue project.
I think that's the sense. I think it really is. There's a little bit of momentum there that hasn't been with the Broad Art Foundation, the museum that looks like it's going to be built just south of Walt Disney Concert Hall as part of the Grand Avenue plan. That wasn't originally supposed to be part of the plan, but as the overall project has been delayed, mostly due to a lack of construction financing for the developer of the project, the museum has stepped in there, and part of the museum plan calls for a new public plaza. But, you know, ultimately, there isn't much reason for folks who are not already living downtown and walking to these venues from places in the area to stay here much longer than, you know, the concerts and the operas and whatnot that they're going to. Or at least that's the sense, and that's been the one more regular criticism, if you will, of the area.
How long does it appear it's going to take before the residential commercial aspect of the Grand Avenue project becomes real?
Well, it's a good question, and it's hard to say. The project itself, which is a $3 billion mega project, is broken into three phases. The extension that you mentioned earlier for 2 years is for phase one. And phase one, it imagines two huge residential towers, 48 stories and 19 stories apiece. That now is not going to break ground, at least until February 2013. That's when the latest extension extends to. However, at the same time, Related is also working with the CRA right now to scale down plans for another possible apartment tower, which seems to be like it's getting on a fast track, but that's still, you know, at least several years away.
Let me introduce James Braswell. He is editor of the Planning Report, but looks at development and land use all over Southern California. It's good to have you back on our program.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Los Angeles, famously a place of many suburbs in search of a city, I think is the cliche. What about all this from a planning standpoint? How many public commons spaces can you have? Is that also something that that is subject to the phrase "more is better"?
I think so, absolutely. And LA, I think this is the Valley Performing Arts Center, especially, is a reflection of two dynamics in the city, and that's one really aiming to be a world-class city on par with New York, London, and Paris, and I think that's what you see going on with this need for a truly world-class public commons like they're trying to develop downtown on Grand Avenue. But also, there is a lot of energy in being put into making more livable neighborhoods, and cultural amenities such as the Valley Performing Arts Center are a great way to leverage infrastructure and reinvestment into neighborhoods to make neighborhoods more livable. And some of the greatest success stories, I think, of neighborhoods around the city and around the region have centered around cultural amenities, such as the Downtown Arts District a little further east of Grand Avenue, and even outside of the city in Culver City. So I think those two dynamics don't have to be contradictory at all, and really can serve the overall livability of the entire region and the city as a whole.
But if there's a public commons, as I understand it, isn't that something that people go to sort of by preference, and aren't other places further away things that they do rarely and sort of on special occasions?
I don't know if there's a preference. Certainly, I think the Grand Avenue schedule is going to be on the higher brow end of the spectrum for people that are looking for that sort of thing. But there's a preference, certainly, for people. I mean, the numbers that have been coming downtown for the Art Walker are pretty amazing, and considering that was all, you know, organically do-it-yourself grown, I think that's a model for future success.
Let me go back to Jolene Kester. You buy this idea that the offerings downtown are going to be higher brow than they are at the Valley Center?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define higher brow. I would prefer to say it'll be different. It'll be different types of performances, different scale, different intensity of offering in terms of how long a show can play. There certainly are more offerings downtown than because there's more theaters. But I know that what we're going to be offering here at the Valley Performing Arts Center will be highbrow for those people who choose to come. It will enliven them. It will nourish them. It will allow them to share that very basic human experience of the cultural and creative arts in ways that they don't have now.
Dale Franzen, director of the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. Are you dealing with middlebrow stuff there?
Well, I actually don't like the expression highbrow at all, because I think it gives completely the wrong impression. I think that what we're all trying to do is bring Los Angeles together in under the umbrella of culture and arts. And I personally, speaking as a classical musician, I don't consider myself highbrow. I mean, I think classical music has been around longer than any of us, and it should be accessible to everybody. We just had a performance of Peter and the Wolf. I don't consider that highbrow. I consider it good music. So I would rather say that I think all of us will strive to put on a diversity of programming, and that's what the public wants. They want to come together for other reasons other than buying merchandise or eating a meal. They want to have a further cultural and community experience, and that's what we're all seeing. I think that downtown LA will be very successful if they meld all those things together, which I'm sure they will. We would all like to go downtown and have more to do in the day that we go down there. The only reason you don't stay now, it's not just because of traffic, it's also there's nothing to do. But, you know, people want to hang out at our theater when the show's over. They hang out in the lobby, they buy CDs, they want another glass of wine, they want to be with the people that have just been with them watching a great violinist or watching a great jazz band. I mean, I think we all in Los Angeles want community and want more of it. The fact that we're giving them the chance now to have it more in their neighborhood is a plus for everybody.
James Braswell of the Planning Report, you mentioned the Art Walk, and there are other grassroots types of events like that. Are they more attractive to young people than these institutions that put on events in big buildings?
I don't think that you can generalize like that across the board about young people, but there certainly seem to be a great deal of young people going to events like Downtown Art Walk and Ciclavia and First Fridays out in Venice. So generalizations are always tricky, but there seems to be maybe greater outreach and greater awareness and just a little bit more of that youthful energy around some of those things.
Ciclavia, tell us, our audience, what Ciclavia is. They may have forgotten.
Ciclavia a few months ago, and also again at the later this year, they shut down quite a bit of streets. I think it's 12 miles or something like that for pedestrian use. So a lot of bicyclists came out. It was just huge numbers. I think around 100,000 on the streets that day. You know, really engaging with the urban fabric on a much more personal level than they can from their cars.
Don't know if that's highbrow or lowbrow. It may depend on how many gears you have on your bicycle. Dale Franzen in Santa Monica, describe your audience at the Broad Stage.
Well, it's funny. What I was going to say is I think who you get in your audience comes down to two things. It comes down to what you're putting on the stage and how you market it. What all of us are experiencing is that we're living at a time when a certain member of our audience, and usually, I hate to generalize, but generally speaking, 45, 50 and above, still want to get paper, still want to talk to a human being, still want to be communicated to by a more traditional brochure. But we have found that if we want to reach 35 and under, they don't want any paper, they don't want to be called, they love getting digital blasts, Twitter, Facebook, all of these things that this is how they communicate. So we have seen a huge rise in younger audience because we've increased our awareness in that way. you know, we just had last week three outstanding classical musicians doing recital, and we had lots of young people there. They weren't the majority of the audience, but there was way more than we thought we would have. And it also comes down to who is on the stage. We had last year the Grammy Award-winning Artist of the Year, Esperanza Spalding. Well, she's 26 years old, so it goes beyond the jazz world. A lot of young people were at that concert because they knew about her. The same way when Cecilia Bartoli became famous at 26 years old as an opera singer, she went outside of the opera audience to a new audience that was closer to her age. So I think a lot of it also has to do with those of us who are producing and presenting. You know, we like to see ourselves on stage. And in a city like L.A., that's challenging. You know, that's challenging. And it's exciting because we have such an incredibly varied, unusual, diverse city. I mean, this isn't, you know, this isn't Iowa or Kansas City. This is Los Angeles. So to put everything that you see on the street on the stage is one of the goals that I have over a long period of time. I want everybody to see themselves up there. So that's something that I think changes how you program and makes you think in a different way than maybe the more traditional presenting.
Dale Franzen, the director of the Broad Stage in Santa Monica, saying, as we all do, that we live in Los Angeles. Ryan Valancourt, back to you again, reporter for the Los Angeles Downtown News. Do people downtown and do people pushing the Grand Avenue project agree that we're all Los Angeles, even if we are 30 miles away from downtown?
Well, I think that's certainly been the sense. I mean, that's been the reality for downtown for so long. I mean, so much of downtown's vitality comes from the fact that it's relying on people visiting from elsewhere. There's definitely been more of a concentrated effort on a civic level to increase the number of people who are living down here and trying to invite various service kinds of businesses, restaurants, and whatnot to keep people here longer. But no, I mean, downtown couldn't possibly be what it is without drawing people in from other parts of the city.
Okay. Ryan Valancourt, again, reporter for the Los Angeles Downtown News, as L.A. searches for a cultural center. Thanks to you. Thanks to James Braswell, editor of the Planning Report, Dale Franzen, director of the Broad Stage at Santa Monica, and Jolene Kester, president of CSUN and one of the leaders of the effort to construct the Valley Performing Arts Center, the newest of the institutions we've been talking about. Thank you all very much for being on our program tonight.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page in a moment. Egypt's ripple effect in the Middle East on Which Way LA. Orman Ali back with Which Way LA. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Tehran on Monday in a revival of the unrest following the allegedly rigged election in 2009. They were met with brutal repression, and two people were killed, with more protests planned for one of their funerals today. It's very difficult to get firsthand accounts of events in Tehran. Farnaz Fasihi is covering the story from Beirut, Lebanon, for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What happened at the funeral today?
The states, basically, the Iranian government hijacked the funeral of the two slain students who were shot and killed on Monday. They bused a number of their supporters to both funerals. They prevented the families, even immediate families, from seeing the body or attending the funeral procession. They locked up all the students who were classmates of the victims in an assembly hall and beat them violently. We have reports that dozens of students, including the dean of the art school where one of the students was attending, has been arrested.
How many people in all do you think have been arrested? I know it's pretty hard to put a number on that.
Well, Tehran's prosecutor's office said that about 1,500 people were arrested since Monday. I mean, that's the official number that they've given out of names that they've released. I think we know that two have been killed. Judging by the rhetoric, it's possible that even the opposition leaders might face prosecution or arrest down the line.
Now, by opposition leaders, you mean the people leading the Green Revolution, so-called?
That's what I mean. Inside of Iran, really, the only legitimate opposition that people follow and look up to is the Green Movement. There are a number of opposition opposition groups outside of Iran, but Iranians like to think that you know, they're at least the ones we talk to and the ones who are in Iran say that the people who are outside are out of touch and like to lead this their own way.
What about Hussein Mousawi, who has been an official of the government, then became a part of the operation? He, as I understand it, is under house arrest, and there are people in the parliament calling for him to be killed?
That's right. We have there are two opposition leaders in Iran, Mir Hossein Mousavi, who is a former prime minister, and Mehdi Karoubi, who is a former speaker of the House. And it's, you know, it's the classic story of a revolution where founders of the revolution who are part of the system eventually become disenchanted and turn into opposition, which is what's happened here. They know the system very well. They know the faults from inside out, and they're able to call on what's wrong with the government and kind of speak in their own language. And yesterday, on Tuesday, a bunch of parliamentarians started shouting for their execution. And we've seen on state media, in all the news reports today, there's a lot of official statements about how the leaders need to be arrested and tried. We also heard that there was a meeting between the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and the commander of the Revolutionary Guard and the Intelligence Ministry. And Mr. Khamenei did not give his approval for the arrest of the opposition leaders. I think they're afraid that if they arrest them, things might get worse.
The United States is taking advantage of this from a propaganda standpoint. Here is a statement made yesterday by the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, on Al Hura, which is a U.S. satellite television that plays in the Middle East. Here's what she had to say.
I don't think anyone in the Middle East, or frankly anyone in the world, would look to Iran as an example for them. That is not where anybody wants to end up, where you are basically in a military dictatorship with a kind of theocratic overlay, which doesn't respond to the universal human rights of the Iranian people. So I don't think there's much to be learned or really in any way followed coming out of Iran when it comes to democracy.
The Secretary of State would seem making an implied comparison to what has happened recently in Egypt. Marwan Bishara is a senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English, and he's the editor and host of Empire, which looks at changes going on in the Arab world. He previously was a professor of international relations at the American University in Paris. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Obviously, there's a lot going on in your part of the world. We've heard a bit about what's going on in Bahrain and about what's going on in Iran. And, of course, the R News was full of what happened in Egypt for many days. How would you put all of these things together?
Well, it seems that what started as one person setting himself on fire has
That would be in Tunis.
In Tunis. Has evolved into major demonstrations. Eventually to national uprising. And what we witness today is a serious revolution of what you termed people power in the Arab world and apparently on the periphery on the Arab world. We've seen signs now not only in Iran, but also we've been hearing stuff about what's going on in Pakistan, where people are simply sick and tired of corrupt governments, of not having their voices heard, and of, in many ways, being oppressed or ignored, marginalized by an economic and a political system that simply does not or is not responsive to their universal rights or to their basic human rights.
Do you think we will see other governments topple?
I think yes. And I think yes, not because of a record of 30 years or 40 years, but of the record of 6 weeks. And this is the problem for all of us who are trying to dabble with what is going on, is that it's happening with the speed of light. And it has been, in 6 weeks, two governments have been toppled, one in Tunisia and the other in Egypt. Major, major problems and complexities in places like Bahrain, Yemen. And hence, as we dabble with this, we can tell that there is a major momentum happening and in a region that is quite interconnected, as you will know, not only through satellite television, where all these countries speak the same language, understand the same demands and pleas, but also a new media that is allowing a new generation of Arabs to come in and play a major role in defining their future.
Marwan Bishara, formerly a professor of international relations at the American University of Paris, now senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English. I want to go back to Farnaz Fasihi, the Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, who's in Beirut watching what's happening in Tehran, talking to people there by various means. No doubt, this protest obviously has been going on for some time. It didn't begin in any sense with what happened in Egypt, although it appears to have been reinvigorated by that. Do the protesters now that are in the street demand a regime change? Or that would be very different from those recognized opponents that you mentioned before who've actually participated in the government.
There seems to be a rift within the opposition as to what the goal is of these street demonstrations. The leaders, as we mentioned, are part of the old guard, and they believe in reforming the existing system. What we saw on Monday was that under the influence of Egypt and Tunisia, people were saying Mr. Khamenei's name in the same breath as Egypt's Hosni Mubarak and Tunisia's President Ben Ali, and asking for him to step down. So this is definitely a radicalization of the protesters' demands in the past year. It started as a post-election crisis, asking for re-election or having a new election, and now it's turning into calls for regime change.
Well, Farnaz Fasihi, I know you're on deadline. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Middle East correspondent with the Wall Street Journal in Beirut. Back to Marwan Bishara with Al Jazeera English. You said 6 weeks, not many years, not 30 years in many cases, happening with the speed of light. This is the first time, is it not, that we've heard the calls for the Ayatollah Khomeini to step down?
Well, we've heard calls before last year, of course, by young people who we didn't exactly recognize their political identity of any sort. But we understand today that the political stagnation that has been part and parcel of Iranian political life or Arab political life is no longer, thanks not to the opposition parties that we've seen in those countries, including in Iran, but to a youthful movement that is capable of saying such things because it is capable of imagining the alternative. So from Yemen to Iran, the youth are proposing new slogans, new horizons for change that political parties are not able to see. Political parties in Iran, in Yemen, even in places like Tunisia and Egypt before them, were only hoping for reform in within the system. I think still today the opposition parties, including Mr. Mousavi in Iran, is hoping for reforming the system. But the youth is hoping for something far more interesting. Some people want a return to normalcy. Youth want extraordinary.
They want regime change then.
They do. I think the youth in the Arab world and in the Muslim world in general now, in countries like Iran and others, would like to see a revolution in the way not only people are running it, but the way it's run, period. Meaning not only just in terms of the faces and in terms of the politicians and those who are managing those regimes, but they want a change in the political structures, in the institutions of the state, in the constitutions, and so on and so forth. And that what defines a revolution rather than an uprising that hopes for a reform.
Quickly, if you can, an update on what's happening in Egypt. There were stories today in the American press to the effect that there's now division among the opponents of the regime in Egypt, and some indication that because the army is moving so fast to change the constitution, that there might be an attempt to co-opt real change in Egypt. What do you say to that?
Well, I think there is a complicity today between Washington and the Egyptian army to contain the situation, to contain it in a positive way, but to contain it nonetheless. And that's why perhaps Friday, perhaps after that, the demonstrations are going to have to come back, the revolutionaries are going to have to come back and put more heat on the army that will still try to maintain its privileges, still try to maintain its role in the political system rather than as the guardian of the political system. Look, this is a work in progress, And it has just started in terms of the removal of Mubarak. The person awaits the removal of Mubarak, the regime.
Again, Marwan Bishara, formerly professor of international relations at the American University of Paris, now senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English. Stay with us, if you will, as I introduce David Kuffel. He is executive director of the Institute of Turkish Studies at Georgetown University. And, Professor, it's good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
The question arises, of course, as to what might happen next, what model might be used if, in fact, there is going to be a substantial change in the way that various countries are run. And Turkey is often mentioned as a possible model. Do you agree that it could play that role? And if so, why?
Well, I do think that the Turkish experience is something that they can model themselves on. I would be a little bit cautious about confusing modeling and then emulating in every respect. I think what the Turks have done in the last 70 to 100 years, and I should take it back that long, is really to transform themselves into a modern democratic republic. And this is not something that can happen overnight. If you look at throughout the Arab world, there's some places like Egypt that would probably be more capable of making this transition a little bit quicker. But it has to have an organic basis, I think, to most of this.
And what do you mean by an organic basis? How does that relate to the 70 to 100 years that you talked about?
Well, in the case of the Turks, you can trace the reform process back to the 19th century. Ottoman Empire, where the whole business of forming a modern state and having this relationship between the governed and the those who are governing it evolved. And so Turkey has not emerged out of nowhere in the course of the last 10 years or so. It's been a long process, iterative process of increasing democratization, but also increasing social structures and social solidarity.
What about the current government of Turkey and its Islamic roots?
Well, this is sort of an interesting thing. They are Islamic in the sense that I like to think of them as being culturally Islamic, and the public space is a secular space, and they are informed. Their values are informed by Islam. But I think that the Islam is left at the doorstep of the government offices, and something that struck me listening to your previous speakers is that religion and Islam did not figure into the description of what is going on throughout the Middle East and beyond right now.
Let me go back on that issue to Marwan Bishara at Al Jazeera. We're informed that apparently the Muslim Brotherhood has begun to form an official party now that it's no longer illegal in Egypt. And there are many people who are concerned about that, thinking that its roots are in Islamic fundamentalism and that it might try to hijack, to use a popular word these days, the revolution in Egypt. What do you say to that?
I would be concerned if they are not transformed into a political party. The idea of having a good portion of the population, whether it's 10, 15, or 25% underground, banned, that is a recipe for disaster in any country, in any nation, especially if they do espouse or accept and say loudly and clearly that they're ready to play with the rules of the game in a pluralistic state with a constitutional government and so on and so forth. I don't want to prolong a long history lesson to myself and to your viewers, but we should all remember that Muslim Brotherhood was created at the same time that the Christian Democrats were created in Europe, back in 1928 and through 1932. And if they have taken the same route as the Christian Democrats, they would have probably end up being Muslim Democrats. But the idea that they have been prosecuted and oppressed for so many decades has allowed them to be radicalized, and some of them, some segments of them, to become jihadists and far more violent. But Muslim Brotherhood have maintained, to a large degree, social networks, have maintained more theological discourse and political discourse rather than taking on any violent action over the last 3, 4, 5 decades. And hence, I think they've earned their place in the political process. I don't expect them to gain power as they did In Turkey, or as the AK Party did in Turkey. But I think for them to be part of the political process in Egypt is a healthy thing. I think it's about time for them to compete naturally with other political parties and for Egypt to live happily ever after. There is no room for more paternalism from the outside. I think Egyptians need to self-determine their sort of government and not have that imposed by anyone, including from Washington.
Marwan Beshawa with Al Jazeera English. Douglas Murray is a journalist, author, director of the Center for Social Cohesion. That's a British think tank. He joins us now. And Douglas Murray, thank you very much for being on our program.
Great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
My understanding is that you're skeptical about whether Islam and democracy are compatible.
Well, no, I think they can be compatible. And in the case of Egypt, obviously, they have to be compatible. What I'm, like many others, concerned about is the involvement of Islamist parties in whatever settlement occurs in Egypt. I mean, the roots, the founding principles of the Muslim Brotherhood are historical fact. The question now is whether they are able to make the leaps, which would, I think, have to be required of them, and indeed any party in the democratic process in Egypt, to have a place at the table. And the hurdles which the Brotherhood would have to go through are, I think, very clear, but may well prove too much for them.
What are those hurdles?
I would say there are four or five. I mean, they need to denounce terrorism by deed as well as word. They need to denounce some of the founders and their founding principles. They need to stop the double standards in relation to criticism of violence. They need to make a statement on the freedom of choice within Egyptian society. And they also have to, I think, crucially and finally, have to make a commitment to obey the laws of the state that follows. I mean, in other words, to obey the will of the Egyptian people, however well they do or however badly they do in a forthcoming election. I mean, we have to remember that the recent precedent of a Brotherhood, you know, branch and election is very unhappy. I'm thinking, of course, of the election of the Hamas in the Gaza. I mean, we just heard the week before last, the Hamas again refused to participate in the next PA and announced elections on July the 9th this year. I mean, it should be a troubling precedent, even for people who don't dig back too far in history, that a recent Brotherhood electoral success, as it were, led to the murder of opposition and effectively, it seems at the moment, a one vote once policy. So there is considerable reason to be concerned here.
Douglas Murray, again, at the Center for Social Cohesion in Britain. Professor Cuthell at Georgetown University, is the current party that is in power in Turkey, does it have roots in the Muslim Brotherhood? Is that where it began?
No, I think the AKP comes from a coalition of a range of people, some of them who are more religious than others, but I've often made the comparison, it may sound a little bit odd, but the AKP resembles sort of the Johnsonian Democrat Party in that the spectrum is very broad. And in fact, it is a refutation of earlier smaller Turkish parties that were more avowedly Islamist and hard line in that respect. So they describe themselves as being moderate. I think that's probably a fairly good way of describing them. I'd also just like to point that there's another case of a Muslim Brotherhood actually working out rather well, and I think if you look at the history in Indonesia with their own indigenous Muslim Brotherhood organization, that has not come to tears. The AKP, I would think, you're looking at something that's even more moderate. I mean, they pay attention and they to their Islamic background, but they don't impose it, in ways that would be deleterious.
Let me go back then to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Marwan Beshawa. You indicated that you thought they were radicalized by repression. Do you think that they could meet the criteria that were laid out by Douglas Murray in terms of renouncing terrorism indeed, as well as action, as he suggested, renouncing the founders and the founding principles, some of those things that he indicated. Would that be necessary, as far as you're concerned, for the Muslim Brotherhood to participate in a democratic government in Egypt?
Let me just preface that briefly by saying the following. The problem with much of what's been said on your show and on other shows over the last 6 weeks is that suddenly the Arab world is being discovered, the Muslim world is being discovered. The Arab world has been invisible. And so because it's been treated through the prisms of Israel or through the prisms of terrorism or the prisms of oil and oil interests, strategic interests, this invisibility is leading to so much misunderstanding because people are simply trying to catch up. It's true that the Muslim Brotherhood was radicalized, especially in the 50s when there was a major crackdown on them, especially in Egypt. But they have evolved over the last two decades. They have come through on a number of questions, including, as I said, parliamentary democracy. And the New York Times published a very important article by one of their leaders, Assam al-Aryan, who is like the Erdogan of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And I disagree with your previous guest. I think the AK Party did come from the overall Muslim Brotherhood that basically were banned by the military in Turkey. But at any rate, I do think that just as the Tories and the Labour Party in England don't have to denounce terrorism, colonialism, and the incredible injustices they've done around the world, far more than any jihadi would have probably imagined, we don't ask for a Tory to run in a parliamentary democracy, in a constitutional monarchy in the UK. I don't think anyone in London, Washington, or LA should be demanding of Egyptians what to do, when to do, and which political parties to run on which platforms. In the end of the day, the Egyptians are saying we need now for a change, not to be client of someone, not to be treated paternalistically by someone. We're going to self-determine what is right for Egypt. And if they do so, bringing on all aspects of the political life in Egypt, including the Muslim Brotherhood, that's a very healthy process. The last thing we need in the Arab world is another oppressive regime that puts out of its political system one-third of its people.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. Douglas Murray, I'm sorry we don't have time for you to respond. Hopefully you'll be back, talk with us more, as will our other guests, again, as we learn more and more about what's going on in this part of the world. Douglas Murray, again, with the Center for Social Cohesion in Britain. Marwan Bishara with Al Jazeera English, senior political analyst, a formerly professor at the American University in Paris. Douglas Cuthell, professor at the executive director of the Institute of Turkish Studies at Georgetown University, and our earlier guest as well. Good to have all of you with us, and thank you very much. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, and Andrea Brody. Our managing producer is Karen Ranziner, technical director Mike Newport. You can email us. You can share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. And you can join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.